Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to the Pinckney to Pinckney Show. I am the Reverend Edward Pinckney. First of all, I want to thank all our listeners and everyone who downloaded the show last week. It was gigantic. Over 200,000 downloads. Now, if I got, even got an email from the Blog Talk Radio Show actually thanking me for the show. But it wasn't me. It was my good friend, Dr. Tams, Michael Tams, Dr. Mark Cree, and I can't think of the other doctor's name, but they did a magnificent job explaining and what we were talking about, COVID-19. I'm going to tell you this. I am very, very concerned about this COVID-19. I have a lot of respect for it. And when I say respect, I mean exactly that. I have a lot of respect for the COVID-19. And I try to do what I can to protect myself and my family at all costs and my friends. It's crucial. But I also got some very, very good news this week. This young lady who's in prison here in Michigan, she had served a total of 32 years. She's going to be released in March. Her commutation was approved, and she will be coming home. Only thing she has to do is survive. If she can survive this COVID-19 or the coronavirus, whichever one you want to label it, she'll be home. She is the 23rd person that we have been able to get released from prison. Also, we're getting another one, a guy released in April. He'd be the 24th, and I got one other guy who's going to be the 25th. We're praying. He haven't got the okay that he was coming on, but we've been working on this case for over 2 years. And I tell you this much, this guy, he's a friend of mine. He had served over 45 years in prison, and he understands the whole movement of what we're going through today. See, a lot of times when people get out of prison, even though they have spent a lot of time, they don't go back and try to help the ones that's in prison. And I find that very, very, very unfortunate. I think any time that you can help someone, you should be able to go out and reach out and help these people. Because, hey, I tell you, it could be them today and you tomorrow. So don't think that you are above this. With this system that we live in today, believe me, they would do anything. Anything. The guy told me, we don't need evidence. He told the jury, we don't need evidence. And the judge repeated, we don't need evidence. We could send you to prison tomorrow if we wanted to. This is the system that we live in. And once these guys are gone, they're going to bring in some more guys who think the same way they do. See, our biggest issue is that we're black. When you're black and dealing with this system, anything can happen. We can't even call the police here, Benton Township. We must have the worst police department in the whole wide world. I cannot believe that they cannot solve a problem, but they can give you a ticket and claim you were speeding. They can do that. You see, they can give you a ticket. And I used to say Benton Harbor was the worst police department in this area. But they're about the same. They're both bad. When I say bad, I mean horrible. I just wish that there was a way that I could not pay taxes so they can receive any money. I have not figured that out yet, but I will. If we ever have a fire, I don't know who to call. If we ever have an issue here, I don't know who to call. You actually can't call the police. especially Benton Township. Benton Township Police Department here in Michigan is horrible. Benton Harbor Police Department here in Michigan is horrible. They're good for nothing. If we could figure out a way how to define them without hurting as a homeowner, you know, if you don't pay the taxes, they'll try to come in and take your house. But if I could figure out a way how not to pay any taxes for the police department, I would do so. They're worthless. And that's a fact. That's not me lying. That's not me just saying something. It's a fact. They can't solve nothing. They can't solve. The only thing they can do if somebody stole some lunch meat, they can arrest him. They can claim someone was speeding and give them a ticket. That's it. Should we be paying all this money to the police department here in Benton Township or Benton Harbor? Worthless policemen, but nobody ever say anything. Nobody. They don't even want to talk about it. Most of the black folks, they scared to even talk about the police. I know the police have put fear in them because they'll shoot you in a minute. Be justifiable homicide, shoot you in the back, claim you had a gun, plant a gun on you, all this kind of stuff. This is what's happening here in Benton Township and Benton Harbor. There was a case earlier where a guy got called out of the house and went outside, and the guy shot him dead. They put a gun in his hand. This is Benton Harbor. They put a gun in the kid that got killed, hand. No powder burns or any time it was a shootout. Never hand. Someone, they put that gun in his hand. Now that same killer is walking around Benton Harbor waiting to kill somebody else and use that same method. Here's the sad news. He's going to get away with it. They don't care. If that boy had been a white boy, if he would have been a white boy, that boy, they would have put him in prison. They probably wouldn't even gave him a trial knowing this place over here. But they don't care. They don't care. All they want you to do is pay your taxes and keep it moving. Well, listen, I'm rattling on, but I just want to let you know the good news. This young female, she's going to be home in March. She spent more than enough time in prison, and it's the work of the Black Autonomy Network Community Organization, BANCO. It's our work. This is what we do. And also a young man going to be getting out, and hopefully my good friend Jerry will be getting out. But on that note, I want to bring in my good friend, the one and only, it's not two of him, it's only one, the one and only, Dr. Times. Let's say Dr. Times. Dr. Hey, that, Times, Reverend Pinckney.
Yeah.
Talk to me.
Okay, thank you. You can hear me. I don't need the what you said earlier was so important that COVID
you
is off, real.
You can't hear me.
How about now? Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Talk to me.
Okay, I was saying that it's so important what you were saying earlier, how COVID is real, and it's affected the Muslim community, the Hebrew Israelite community, so it affected everybody in the black community, and what we see that the effect, if our people do not focus on health, then they're likely to die four times greater than that of their white counterparts. If our people do not stop the smoking, if our people do not stop the alcohol, if our people do not stop the drugs, and yes, I have to tell you that smoking weed is also an inflammatory agent to the lungs, that thing, if our people who hang around young people, allow their grandchildren and great-grandchildren to come around them, who are potential carriers in the black community, then that becomes a problem. Now, a lot of the European American communities are carriers because some of them don't believe in wearing masks, and so forth. They'll bring it to the African American community, and the African American community will die. That's just statistical facts right now. So what we have to do is that, one, we got to make sure that all of our African American people are doing a complete multivitamin that has zinc in it, 3 pills a day. They're doing 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C, 3 pills a day, and that they're doing a coenzyme, or also called CoQ10, at least 200 milligrams of that a day. They're going to need to be drinking at least 8 to 12 hot glasses of coffee, tea, or some hot drink. This is what they're being used in China. They're doing a steam bath where they have a pot of hot steam and they put a towel over their head and breathe that in. All of that seemed to be helping the lungs, because the death rate in China now is much, much, much lower than the United States. Even the number of cases, because people now have it under control with doing these simple things. The other thing is, if you can't hold a conversation, you have corona until proven otherwise. So one of the things that was happening with the African American community, the black community, that they were being staying at home too long, and that they were being directed to quarantine. But the people who were telling them to quarantine were not medically trained and did not understand that you quarantine while you're healthy, see the doctor while you're sick. You quarantine while you're healthy, see your doctor while you're sick. And so that's an issue that we had to address. And what we, once we did these things, that we also added that senior citizens not only had the mask up, but also glove up, so that when they leave their house, they glove up. And then when they come in back to their house, they take the gloves off and throw it in the trash. When we introduced the multivitamins with the zinc and the CoQ10 and the vitamin C and the hot drinks and no dairy products, because dairy makes mucus, and we did the glove up, mask up, glove up, safe up routine for the city of Benton Harbor, which is like the sister city of Flint, which is like the sister city of Detroit in terms of our 85% black population. We were supposed to have the same death rate, but through the blessings of the God, the Creator, what has happened from March 1st till now, we only had 9 deaths, 5 men and 4 women, from doing what I just told you now. And what I'm saying, this is for other African-American communities to practice this, to do this. The other thing I'm going to tell you is, a vaccine is not a treatment. A vaccine is not a treatment. A vaccine is not a treatment. It's a preventative measure that you do down the road. It's for you to try to build up antibodies to prevent the infection. Now, the vaccine is a money maker. A vaccine is to be produced to make money, and people have patents on vaccines. And the thing about a vaccine, we normally don't release it until 2 years out, but what's happening because of the pandemic, that the general population will be the study subjects, that the general population will be the study subject. And if there's death, harm, or injury that occurs to it, you cannot hold anybody liable. There can nobody can be sued. And that's why some people who have the Proud Boys mentality, some people have the Ku Klux Klan mentality, the White Citizen Council mentality, those individuals want the African-American community tested first and the Hispanic community tested first. So if there are any deaths, it will help to decrease the number of the African-Americans and Hispanics in this community. We also know that because of the number one issue that was never addressed, that started to be addressed, was the public health issue that was paramount, was racism. That has never been addressed. The United States condemned the United States on racism, especially when it comes to African Americans and the killings by police. And you can look up the United Nations and you'll see that condemnation from the World Court and the whole United Nations, because we have refused to deal with the number one mental illness, the number one health crisis, the number one environmental crisis, the number one in terms of real estate crisis and housing is racism, which is a mental health disease that consists of delusions of grandeur, where you think your race is the best. Denial of reality, where you deny the contributions of others or even the humanity of others. Projection, whatever faults that you have or shortcomings you have, you place it in that race or that group of people. Then you have rationalization, where you can rationalize putting your neck on someone and suffocating them to death. And then the next one is called obsessive compulsive behavior, where you do extreme measures like is suffocation. Like putting an African-American on the back of a truck and dragging him till his body comes apart. Like killing babies in the maternity wards. Like killing mothers on that OB ward. Like the fact that a gentleman could be on the phone and you will murder him in a Walmart when he's talking on the phone with the buying a toy gun. So, and the fact that you will accept that as being justifiable, that indicates a mental illness. And so when it comes to COVID right now, there is no justification scientifically, there is no justification historically that the mentality that started the Tuskegee experiment, that started medical apartheid, has changed. There's no evidence that anyone in the African-American community should trust anybody who been done everything in their power to try to kill them, and now they're going to turn around and say, we're trying to save you. If everything has been to George Floyd you, to Breonna Taylor you, to Eric Garner you, to Sandra Bland you, everything has been done to try to kill you, and now these same people say they want to save you. No, that shows mental illness if you believe that. And what you also have to go back is to the 1705 and the 1710, the Casual Killing Act, and Mortorius Manumission, which dictates that you will use black people, that you will use slaves to enslave, that you will use slaves to keep the slaves in line and to keep the status quo. And they chose the professors, those who they'd allow to be educated, to help keep the slaves in slavery. They asked for the pastors, to allow the pastors to also help keep the slaves enslaved. They also asked for the athletes to help to keep the slaves enslaved. They asked for the entertainers to help keep the slaves enslaved. And if you look today, because Dick Gregory even said it, if you look today, who are they sending to you? They send a black face to enslave you. They sent the black face more to talk to the Africans about trade, and then they wouldn't kidnap the Africans, and that's how we wound up here. They sent the black man, Anthony Johnson, to the courts to try and enforce lifetime servitude, because everything up until that time was a 7-year servitude, and then you were free in the United States. So they used a black man to lifetime enslave other black men. So anytime they want to eliminate a race, they send a black face. So anytime they want to harm a race, they send a black face. Anytime they want to kill a race, they send a black face. And that's why you'll see black women and men put in the media by white men to go out to, and to harm and to do injury to black men and to black women. They're always going to send that injured mentally, low self-esteem, not knowing any correct black history, not knowing about Egypt, not knowing about Nile Valley civilization, that someone who doesn't know their history, but who's been tricked to be believed that they are a test tube baby, that they are a test tube baby created during slavery, that they're a test tube baby created in slavery. Because if you do not have a continent or landmass that your people come from, then you were a creation in a lab. So if you feel that you are not from Africa, that means that you are a product that was made by Southern whites during the enslavement period. And the enslavement period started in 1492. Everybody has a landmass. Everybody has a basis of history and a basis of origin. So all of that plays a role into why we see that COVID, black COVID, is also black injustice. Where we see black COVID is also black environmental injustice. Where we see black COVID shows a healthcare disparity. So I'm addressing the issue, can we trust the scientific community? Can we trust the medical community? And the answer is hell no. And so after that, I'm going to let you onto our team, the public healthcare team, which is Dr. Anita Moncrief, and followed by Michael Tynes, who will be dealing with the origin of racism and expanding on his systemic dose. Yes, Reverend.
All right. Very, very good. We'll start with Dr. Moncrief. Dr. Moncrief, are you there? Talk to me.
Yeah, and she has a way to keep safe by bringing things into your homes.
All right. Dr. Moncrief?
Yes, this is Dr. Moncrief. Can you hear me?
All right. I can hear you now. Talk to me.
Great. I'm sorry about that. I didn't know how to unmute, but I just wanted to just, you know, follow up a little bit on the things that Dr. Tynes had said. I agree with Dr. Tynes 200%. You know, there's treatments out there that are not being expressed are not being shared, particularly among our people. And these treatments are not necessarily, you know, involving, you know, drugs, you know, basic things to help avoid it. Like Dr. Tynes was saying, there's a lot of vitamins that are involved here. They won't hurt you. It won't hurt you to try to use these things. It may not stop you from getting COVID, but what it will do is if you do contract it, it will boost up your immune system so it'll help you fight off COVID. And so people, we need to take control of our own health destinies. We don't want to be at the door of the hospital or somebody offering us the option of being put on a ventilator. We want to start taking control very, very early of our own health and our own destiny, particularly with this COVID virus. Please take it very, very seriously. You have the government over in England, you know, canceling Christmas, okay? You shouldn't need, and I, this is just the way I feel, and I'm just going to say it. You shouldn't need white folks to tell you not to go out and celebrate Christmas the way you've been celebrating all these years. If we need white people to tell us that, then, you know, what does that say about us? We should and we should exercise common sense, and that's what we're doing. We didn't know that COVID was going to affect black people the way it did back in February, March, and April. We didn't know. We should have known because we always disproportionately suffer from diseases, but we didn't know, okay? But now we know. In May, when we realized what was going on, when we started seeing data, then we started, particularly in the state of Michigan, in the city of Detroit, we started saying, hey, let's isolate ourselves. Let's wear masks. Let's wash our hands. We were saying that before the CDC, the Surgeon General of the United States came out and said, you know, wear a mask. We had already figured it out. We have always been a brilliant people, okay? So we figured it out. Our incidence has decreased, but it has not gone away. And then after we figured it out, we started seeing other people walking around without their mask on, and we started thinking, well, maybe it's safe. No, it's not safe. We figured it out. Stay figured out, okay? Things are not better. Things are worse. More people are dying today than were dying back in February, March, and April from COVID, okay? But it doesn't have to be us. We can protect ourselves by doing those basic things and choosing. Christmas is nice. Christmas trees and gifts are nice to share with your family. But we can choose not to travel. We can choose not to have large family gatherings, okay? It's not really that important when it comes to you deciding whether or not to stand together and sing Christmas carols around a tree or not be allowed to see a family member on a ventilator in a hospital. It's not a hard choice, okay?
No, I agree. I agree with you 100%. Let me ask you this question, Dr. Macri, before you go on.
Yes.
So would you recommend people not take the vaccination?
And that was the next thing I was going to try to address. Okay.
All right. Go right ahead then.
All right. So we've been debating, before COVID, okay, we've been debating whether or not to get, you know, flu shots, immunizations, okay? And main thing people point out is like the Tuskegee study is a reason why we shouldn't trust the government, okay? I think that's a very good reason why we shouldn't trust the government, okay? But sooner or later, we're going to have to move past that, and I don't know when that time is, okay? But let's look at what's going on today. You've got this virus out there, okay? Well, let's look what's going on a year or so ago, okay? You've got influenza out there, and you've got people dying from influenza every year. Last year, I think 30,000 people died from influenza. And people are getting the vaccine, so that's cutting down on people getting influenza. And if they get influenza anyway, they don't get as sick, so they're not dying. So you have a history of vaccines, of a flu vaccine that seems to work, okay? Not only that, but it took years to develop this flu vaccine for influenza. They didn't rush it through in 9 months. It took years to develop it, and each year they have to change the vaccine a little bit to accommodate the different strands of influenza, okay? I received the flu vaccine on several occasions, all right? Now, COVID, which is a novel virus, is a new virus. We don't know much about COVID, okay? But you've got people rushing to develop a vaccine, which they should do for COVID. But now instead of years of research, they've done it in, let's say, about 18 months, okay? Because we've known about COVID, but they've known about COVID longer, all right? So they've started, you know, going into this investigating of a vaccine. And now they've got a whole new different science on developing a vaccine. They got this messenger RNA. Okay, there's no, to my knowledge, there's no other vaccines who they've used this type of technology, messenger RNA, on. And now they say, oh, this messenger RNA, it works very, very, very well. And we can get 94% of people who will get this vaccine. It's, quote, effective. Effective means that, and I'm stretching it with this. Effective means that if you are exposed to it, COVID-19, you will not contract COVID-19, okay? And so that's what I said, I'm stretching it, because we always throw in that caveat, well, yeah, but if you do contract it, it'll be a milder form, okay? So we don't know that much about COVID, though. And then we've only tested the COVID vaccine for only a few months, okay? Maybe 6 months at the most, and again, I'm stretching it, because most of their data goes with 3 month results of the COVID virus. So you don't know if you get the vaccine today that 6 months from now the vaccine will be totally ineffective and that you can get COVID again, right? So we don't know a lot.
Right.
But what we do know is it has not been through the same type of trials, and you can't look at the longevity of it. You don't know, just like you don't know if the vaccine will be effective 6 months from now, you don't know 6 months from now if the vaccine has some type of long-term side effect, because it just hasn't been tested in humans, okay? So it goes back to the question, would you get the vaccine? What I did was I talked to a couple of pulmonologists, lung specialists, one African-American and one European-American. The European-American one was a female who was 70 years old. The African-American was a male who's approaching 70, not quite 70, he's over 65. Both of them, lung specialists, said that they would get the vaccine, okay, white one and black one. I spoke to two African-American, one kidney specialist and one kidney surgeon, both of them African-American, both of them are in their 40s. Both of them said they would get the vaccine. I spoke to a primary care doctor who sees patients on, I spoke to two primary care doctors, let me take that back, who see patients, both of them African-American, okay? One of them said, I just got the shot because I'm out there on the first line and I'm seeing these people who are sick, you know, and if I can avoid it, you know, I will, okay? The other one said that there's no way under the sun that he's going to get that vaccine at this time, all right? So I tell you all of that because all these doctors are taking the vaccine except for one. But my logic would be, to the general public, okay, it's going to be a little while before the vaccine is available to the general public. So
right,
why don't
right.
those of us in the general public just sit back and watch and see what happens to these people who are getting the vaccine, okay? If the vaccine is available to the general public in April, that's going to put us 4 months into it, and so you're going to have an idea, you know, on a larger scale of whether or not the vaccine is effective and what the side effects of the vaccine are going to be. okay? So my suggestion to the general public is don't get excited, you know, wait till it's available to the general public, and then look back and see what has happened to people who have gotten the vaccine. To the first responders, not the doctors, okay, to the first responders, that's a different story, because the first responders are going to be offered the vaccine soon, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And for the first responders, you know, it's a hard decision to make. If I was out there on the front line, I'm still hesitant, okay? And I'm one of the few black physicians who will say that. You know, most, like I said, the ones I talk to, they're saying, like, they're going to get it, okay? Me, if somebody walked up to me tomorrow and said, here's your first dose of Pfizer, I would be like, no, thank you, okay? Because you just haven't done the work. I'll just wash my hands, wear my mask, you know, put on my face shield, do what I need to do, what I've been doing up to this point, okay?
Absolutely. So,
but it's an individual choice.
Yeah. But let me say this to you, too. I figure if, you know, it's not really going to be available to the public, I'm looking at June, July. I don't see in April. I don't see it. But, you know, I don't know everything there is in the world. And I'm looking at around June, July before it'd be offered to the public. And it may be even later than that. I'm just thinking and seeing how things are going right now. One of the things that I said this to myself, if everybody get it, get the shot, get the vaccination, then I don't have to worry about getting it because I'll be covered by them. That's my way of thinking, doctor. Is there something wrong with me thinking like that?
That's one way of thinking, but you have to think of it also like this. If everybody gets their polio immunization, then that cuts out people getting polio. But everybody's got to get it. If there's a few people who don't get it, as long as there's a few people who don't get their immunization, you're going to always have polio coming back around. And I don't know if you, like, a year, 2 years ago, we had this, you know, polio outbreak, you know, in the United States, and in Michigan, it was largely located to one of our Jewish communities in Oak Park, okay, because the children had not been immunized, okay. So if everybody gets it, that means if everybody gets the immunization, that means everybody gets the immunization. As long as those of us are out there who don't get it, we will keep the disease alive. But I just want to – I don't have a problem with the immunization if the immunization works and if the side effects and stuff are known. And this one was just pushed through too quickly, and the science is just too new for me to be running out there saying that, I'm going to take the vaccine.
Mm. All right, very good.
Vicky, may I say something?
You may. Yes, you may.
Okay, so number one, as I told you, back in the old days, in 1757-10, they appointed the professors, the pastors, the athletes, and the entertainers, and now you have to look at the physicians as being perpetrators of wrong being done to the African American. And what Dr. Moncrief will tell you is that most physicians are like sheep. Who runs medicine right now are the CEO and businessmen. They tell the doctors what to do. What was left out was the fact that individuals like myself and maybe others, we fought because they were trying to make the vaccine mandatory. And the statement is, if you're trying to make it mandatory, then that means you're practicing medicine without a license. If you're trying to make it mandatory, that means that you are doing like Hitler, and then you also make the physicians like the Nazi physicians of Germany, now the SSS. So you have to understand that these physicians are normally broken individuals who do not have a strong black history background, who do not have a self-esteem. They're not going to speak the name of Malcolm X. They're not going to speak the name of Marcus Garvey. They're not going to speak the name of Angela Davis. These individuals have been trained to try to be white, not to be black physicians, but to be dark-skinned white physicians with white coats. So I'm going to keep it 100. All of us know that, number one, that this has been rushed through, and Dr. Moncrief was being gracious on the time, because what happened is that they were just still studying and they didn't get a handle on it until almost April or May, in terms of being able to start to try to synthesize this messenger RNA virus, which goes into the DNA, which she was telling you that don't even know the results of how to be studied. Now, they thought that also one statement might be that it might weaken some of the retroviral treatments in HIV. So we don't know that yet. But the thing is that there is no liability attached to this virus, this vaccine that's going to treat this virus, because they do not know, and they got a special clause because it's a pandemic. Now, what you also have to know, that the pandemic is mainly in Europe and the United States. If you go on the world map, you will see that the United States has a problem and Europe has a problem. Wuhan, China, and China don't have a problem. One of the least place hit is all Africa, and wherever you have it in Africa, you're going to have it where it's around where European tourists or European businessmen. You'll also see that the island of St. Lucia was free of COVID until they opened up the resort hotels, and now that the hotel employees took it into the community. So everybody is not having it to the same degree of United States. United States is behind the rest of the world. So what I'm saying to you is that patience and waiting, this is your, remember, it was a black woman who ran the Tuskegee experiment. Once the black doctors infected the black men of Tuskegee during a health screening program, a health prevention program, they even sent a black male doctor in there to see if via the program. He was kind of rejected. So would they use a black woman to run the Tuskegee experiment? And the other thing you need to talk, Tuskegee experiment just not didn't finish until into the 2000s, just recently. That 1970 was exposed, but they kept it going and tracking the data up until just recently when they were exposed. Now, the same thing they did, they took a black woman, a light-skinned black woman, and they used her for the FBI, for the white men of the FBI, to monitor and set up Dr. King. And then they used this black woman who was so in the love of the white people that she was the black woman that stabbed Dr. Martin Luther King in the chest with a knife. Because people keep forgetting that when Dr. King was alive, a lot of black people didn't like him and a lot of white people didn't like him. But once he was dead, everybody loved him. So they can't give me all this King stuff, because I was in terms of being a little kid and tracking down the history. And so we still have that racist mentality. We still have those house Negroes that Malcolm X called them, trying to do us in, and the number one field of house Negroes is going to be your politicians and your physicians. We're going to put that in there. Yeah. So we need to be patient, and we need to wait like any other vaccine for when the data comes. The flu vaccine was forced on doctors against their will, but even not the data, because of the businessmen, and they would not be able to see patients in the hospital or have a position in the hospital, because your doctors now are not the Charles Drew like before, the Charles Vincent's like before. They're not the Lionel Swans like before. These doctors now, 90% of them are cowards. 90% of them are cowards on being black, 90% of cowards being white, and the other ones are also pro oppression of the black race. And you need to go look on the data about the racism in medicine. So we need to be patient on this. There is no justification on this earth for any black patient, any African patient, to trust white medicine right now. They don't have that track record. They have to earn that respect.
All right, Doc. Let's bring in the young historian. Let's work on him now. Let him tell us what he wants us to know.
What about racism and his DOPES program?
All right, Michael Times, are you there? Talk to me.
Yeah, I am here. Hello.
How you doing today?
I'm all right. How are you doing?
Okay, we've been waiting on you because we got some raving reviews about you. So we want you to start wherever you want to start, and we want you to talk about whatever you want to talk about. Whatever your heart desire, you can talk about it, because right now you got the floor. So talk to me.
Yeah, so I actually didn't have anything specifically set up. I intended to more so go off of questions or anything from last time that you or anyone else wanted me to follow up on, if you had any questions or specific.
that's good. But what I want you to do, can you kind of like just refresh our memories on some of the stuff that you was talking about? You don't have to go through the whole presentation, but what I want you to do, I want you to talk about something just to refresh the listeners that everybody wasn't listening to the program last week. You see, they don't know what you talk about because. But I want you to talk about something. Tell us about racism, how it started, and all that kind of good stuff that you know about.
The word race was obviously used before for a different thing than what it is used now. Originally, race was used to refer to people, speakers of a common language or of a common national identity if they came from the same culture. That was how the term race was used. Sometime between the 16th and 17th century, however, there was a change in the usage of the word where it became more commonly used to refer to categories of human beings and, you know, in particular, the phenotypic traits that human beings possess. So physical traits like skin color, your particular nose shape, and your hair type. The reason for this change was mostly a financial one, one for justifying a particular capitalist system that was exported by Europe, by a European colonial machine. There's a lot of exploitation, a lot of murder, raping and robbing that was done in the pursuit of money to be made by this European colonial regime. And race was used as a convenient justification for a lot of that, what we would today call criminality. Because you have to remember, the reason why, you know, what we today would call crime was committed as the most preferred means of making money back then is because crime is, after all, the fastest way to make a lot of money, the way usually with the least amount of ethical oversight. And so at the time, even if you wanted to do that to humans, there wasn't really much of a support system you could rely on because other people, regardless of where they came from, whether they were European, African, Asian, if they felt that you were doing that type of thing, like raping, robbing, or murdering a particular population of individuals to other humans that they identified with, they wouldn't have really stood for that. And people still don't stand for that. It's why the process of dehumanization is necessary for an extermination of a particular population of people, similar to what you saw in Nazi Germany, the dehumanization of the Ashkenazi Jews as well as other groups via propaganda. So race provided a useful way of categorizing a particular population of people that Europeans wanted to exploit, Africans, and allowed them to redefine the image of the African to be one that's less like a human and more likened to an animal, considering the fact that, you know, we nonchalantly kill billions of animals every single year, billions of land animals in the United States, and people don't really bat an eye. And the reason for that is because that perceived difference in humanity between human beings and an animal, say like a cow or a chicken, comes with all sorts of beliefs most people have in their head, like, well, they don't suffer as much, they can't feel as much pain, it's not that bad because, you know, they were going to die anyway in the wild. It's just a matter of instinct that they have. They're not really feeling any sort of sorrow. Whether those are substantiated or unsubstantiated, those are kind of some of the things that people think. So when you liken people to animals, it makes it easier for people to sit through the extermination of a populace like that. Now, I mentioned that was used to justify the particular money-making schemes that Europeans employed. The way race has impacted society today, most prominently in the United States, is more so along the lines of psychology. So when you look at the voting patterns of populations of European Americans, and you go, for example, down south to see why certain populations of European Americans, white people, vote against things they know that would help them, like healthcare expansion, Medicaid, as an example, or the Affordable Care Act, you'll find that a lot of the times these people vote against things they know will benefit them just because they feel that it'll also forestall other racial populations from getting those things too. So if you have a group of white people in from down south and you're going to tell them, hey, you know, this Affordable Care Act expansion, this is going to give you better health care, that's going to help you address your pre-existing condition, it's likely going to improve the lifespan as well as the health span of the people in your community and, you know, your friends and family members, they'll be willing to vote on it up until the point where you tell them or they become aware of the fact that this program isn't discriminatory in nature, at least explicitly, and it's going to be offered to all people regardless of their race. That's when they'll knowingly make that decision to vote against it. They'll do the same thing with, tax redistribution, tax money redistribution for investment in education, investment in schools. They'll block that as well, even if it impacts their own friends and family members. And a lot of these white people, when you ask them and you survey them, they'll tell you this. They'll tell you that they're doing it not because they're quote-unquote voting against their own interests. This is one of the big lies that's propagated. Their primary interest is actually to forestall meritocracy, forestall equal opportunity. They'll be more concerned with that than they are their own health. So that's how racism has evolved over time up until the modern day. Now it's psychological insecurity. It's white fragility, if you will, a white fear of competing equally with other racial populations, not just Africans, but undeniably most prominently, most pronounced is the fear of competing equally with Africans. You see it from both European American males and females. However, there is a little bit of a difference between the sexes. You see European American males having more of a fear of competing equally with African males. And so they vote against policies that would help them knowingly, causing harm to themselves and their own community. So that's the origin of racism, kind of briefly summarized. What it is today, mostly people just sabotaging themselves out of fear of competing equally. And that's all I can say on that, unless you have another question for me to follow up on.
So what you're saying is that they're hurt themselves along with trying to hurt black people too? You mean they was, if they thought something that was going to help black people, they would vote against that, even though it's going to hurt them too.
They do, right? So this is actually this is already history that they have, and they continue to. So absolutely, they already do this. Yes, there is a deep fear. That's what modern day racism among the populace, the majority. White population or majority European American population in the United States, that's what racism to them actually is. It's a deep fear of competing equally with Africans. And so you do a couple things to get around this. One, like I said, you vote against policies, even policies that harm yourself. You self-sabotage if it means you can forestall meritocracy, because some policies, should they be enacted, would maybe improve the lives of other Africans and other racial populations. And you may fear that if their lives get better and things start to get more equalized, you won't be able to at least superficially seem like you do so much better than them. So that's one way you do it. Vote against policies that hurt yourself to prevent meritocracy. Another way you express this is through projection, psychological projection. The main reason why people who are ideologically white, and that is an ideology, it's different than European American, that's ancestry, but people who are ideologically white, whether they're European whites, whether they're Asian whites, they will project negative things that they secretly believe about themselves onto populations that they fear competing equally with. So when white people call Africans lazy and they promote and propagate this stereotype, make no mistake, they're very much aware of the fact that they are the only population, racial population in the United States that ever had to make it illegal for any other population to compete with them. That's not a very superior thing to do. It's not a thing that an industrious population would do. It's something that a very scared, cowardly, lazy population who's inept would do. And they're aware of it. They're aware of this contradiction. So what do you do when, you possess something you don't want to possess, which is namely a feeling of imposter syndrome? you throw whatever bad quality you have or you believe you have onto another person, and you try to, I guess, kill that costume, your own costume characteristics you try to throw on someone else, you try to kill that on them by pushing it on them and demonizing them with the things you hate about yourself. So they'll call you lazy as an African because what they're thinking is, you know, over and over again, why is my population the only population that ever had to make it illegal for other people to compete with us? Why is my population the only population that ever needed to install anti-literacy laws to prevent other people from reading and writing? Why is my population the only population in America that ever needed to, you know, steal other people's labor and, you know, inventions for centuries? That creates a lot of instability in them, and they try to throw that onto you to get it out of them. So that's another way they express that deep uncertainty and fear about their ability to compete and operate on a level playing field with other racial populations in America, especially Africans.
Wow, that's amazing. Did you know that 67% of all white people that live in Barron County are supposed to be racist? And how I got that number 67, a lady wrote me a letter, a very wealthy lady here in Barron County, and she was embarrassed. She said, Reverend, we should have been out helping you. You know, the people here, she did this. She wrote me a letter. She lived in St. Joe. And she said that, you know, 67% of the white people that live in this area are racist. She said, but this is what she said. She said 33% are not. And she said, this is what she said. She said, but the problem is the 67% overpowers the 33%. They don't want to be in that number where they can come after them. And she said, yes, she said, if they found out that I wrote you a letter, that they would come after me and my husband, and we rich. And that shocked me, hearing some stuff like that, how they keep people in line, also their own kind, white folks, in fear, because they don't want them to commingle with black folks. That,
yeah.
To me, that was one of the most amazing things I ever heard of. But give me your take on something like that.
Yeah, I can speak to that. So we're talking about politically correct racism now. And the shift towards politically correct racism actually was, I'll just say that it came about with the commencement of the Civil Rights Movement. What happened after the Civil Rights Movement was America did not stop functionally being a white ethnostate, meaning, you know, a state that confers privileges or benefits to people on the basis of their ethnic identity. America is still functionally a white ethnostate. Now, that isn't the only type of privilege you can, you know, garner in America. You can be privileged because you're rich or you're wealthy, regardless of your race. But America is still functionally a white ethnostate. It just isn't explicitly one. This was the trade-off after the Civil Rights era. America decided to trade disproportionality for absolutism. Absolutism means you can write a law, an explicit law, and have it be on the books saying no Negroes allowed in this neighborhood or whites only. Disproportionality means you can't do that. You have to take down those white-only signs. But if you figure out that, you know, like African-American disproportionately have worse credit scores, right, in 1969 after the Fair Housing Act, then you can say that you don't want people of a certain credit score to be allowed in your neighborhood. But you can't explicitly say things on the basis of race anymore. They're still disproportionately, intentionally targeting one racial population. They just don't do it explicitly. They make the racism politically correct. And there's a reason why they do that, which is counter to, which actually speaks to why the individual you spoke to, I can't speak to that specific occurrence, but that's not an uncommon occurrence. The reason why there's such a strong, visceral, negative reaction to people who speak on racism in, you know, communities that are predominantly European American, especially if they themselves are European American, is because that stands to weaken the goal of politically correct racism. That stands to weaken that trade-off that white America did with absolutism and disproportionality, meaning just like Lee Atwater told us using the Southern strategy, you can't really say the N-word explicitly anymore. You can't really say, you know, nigger, nigger, nigger anymore. You have to trade that in for low income or welfare queen. And the reason you do that is because it's more marketable globally. It's more marketable. A lot of Americans aren't really politically, historically, and or scientifically literate and about their own, you know, about America, where they live. So you can pretty much guarantee that foreigners across the globe are going to be even less literate, you know, on average, about American politics, American history. So it's better marketing if you use dog whistle terms instead of using the exact explicit term that you're actually talking about, right? Instead of saying the N-word, it's better if you just say low income. You can get away with that more without being detected. And that woman, if she was herself European American, which is what I gathered, she doing that, she stood to weaken or hinder those efforts. And what the efforts actually are exactly what I said earlier. Make sure that they don't have to compete equally with Africans. And right now, obviously, there's a lot of stress on their part about successfully achieving that, because there's been so much attention put on racial inequalities and systemic racism, and they hate that because that's just one step closer in their mind to an equal opportunity meritocracy being installed and that and those white privileges being eradicated. Just
and
you know,
that,
to
it also tells us why Trump has so many followers too. One of the things I always say that racism sells. You know, if you could go around here, just like George Wallace used to use these terms, these racial terms. Now you got Trump using the same thing. And I told people, you know, I told them, I said, racism sell. I told them back in 2015. I said he's going to get more followers than you could ever imagine, because he's saying stuff now that most white folks want to say, but they're afraid to say. And now they think it's safe to say what he's saying.
Yeah. So for your listeners, they should probably be aware of, you know, he's a very infamous guy. A lot of people know him in the political space. His name was Lee Atwater for short. I think his full name was like Harvey Leroy Lee Atwater. Lee Atwater was a American political consultant and strategist for Republicans. And he was an advisor actually to some U.S. presidents, namely the Bushes. To Reagan and George W. Bush Sr., as well as other Republicans. And he was popular back then for spreading the Southern strategy type of rhetoric, where you go around and you tell white people that it's not very politically tenable for you to say things like the N-word anymore, or say you don't want blacks in your neighborhood. Here's what you need to do so we all know what codes we're speaking in. We can understand each other. You say terms like low income, and we all know that means N-word, but the media may not know it, or the African-Americans may not know it, or people globally may not know it, so we can speak in code and know what we mean when we say we don't want low-income people in our neighborhoods. And when someone tries to say, hey, don't you just mean by low income you're talking about black people? We can say, well, no, that's not true, because you don't have to be black to be low income. You can be all different types of people if you're low income. And you can even say that, hey, if you're associating low income with black, then you're really the racist, because you're saying that all blacks are low income implicitly, when in reality the truth is they were using it as a dog whistle term. So most racism is going to be covert and passive aggressive. I don't think that if European Americans – given the psychological perceptions they have of African Americans, which in America means they see African Americans on average as being larger, more muscular, and more threatening, even when you correct for sex, height, weight, and age. That's psychological subconscious difference in perception is actually still there. Given that they see African Americans as being more threatening subconsciously, I don't think they're really going to, you know, explicitly express their racism, aside from, you know, some individual anecdotal occurrences of it. So most of it's going to be covert, and it's going to be dog whistles. They're not going to say it explicitly. It's going to be more, you can say, cowardly, if you will. So yeah, that's that covert racism.
Wow, that's amazing. Listen, I want you to take 2 minutes, and I want you to tell my listening audience whatever your heart desires, just tell them something.
you know, because I think they're on the edge of their seats just listening to you. And I tell you, it's a thrill to talk to you, Mike. I tell you, we got raving reviews on last week, and I'm expecting the same thing this week. But I want you to just take a couple of minutes out and just say whatever your heart desires. Talk to my audience.
Yeah, sure thing. So I'll finish up a little bit what I was saying about covert racism, actually, because it's particularly topical and important right now. You know, I'm certainly not going to make any claims I don't have evidence to substantiate about, you know, the efficacy of a vaccine or even the intentionality behind this particular vaccine. I won't talk about that. I'll just speak more generally and say that given that there was this change in America between explicit absolutism, explicit white ethnostate privileges being given to white people by saying no Negroes allowed here, whites only, given that there was that change from that to implicit racism, saying things that you can, you know, get away with that don't absolutely decrease or absolutely prevent the numbers of African Americans in certain places, but that just disproportionately do, like saying things like low income people or no, you know, welfare queens, things like that. Given that that did occur, the significance of that is that most of the people who are going to be effective in promoting racist outcomes in society, whether it's whatever part of society it's in, are going to be people who've traded in, you know, Klan hoods and burning crosses, or you know white nationalist paraphernalia for medical scrubs, lab coats, police badges, and business suits. It's going to be implicit. It's going to be covert. So you'll just have to be mindful of that. And one of the ways it usually comes about or expresses itself is under the guise or under the illusion of helping or aiding the African population. One thing that I'm really worried about right now, due to the fact that almost no one is aware of it, and that's by part of that's intentional. I can't say all that, but part of it is intentional. What people choose to talk about and not talk about in academia, and where they choose to talk about it and not talk about it. One of the things I'm worried about is African genetic diversity. African genetic diversity is greater than the genetic diversity of all other continental populations of humans combined. So Europeans, Asians, Native Americans combine that, Africans are more genetically diverse than that. Meaning that Africans will possess both the most extreme genetic variant traits and the highest frequency of those extreme genetic variant traits. So you can use skin color as a guide. We know Africans have really, really black, dark skin, but that doesn't characterize Africans. Africans aren't just black skin. They also have the highest frequency of albinism of any continental population, so also the lightest, whitest skin. So Africans have skin tones that are black, white, brown, and everything in between, the largest range. If you use that range in skin color, you can apply that to everything surrounding, you know, genetic traits, genetic variant traits. If you're wondering what population will have the most extreme variant trait from this side of the spectrum and from the other side of the spectrum, as well as the highest frequency, you can use that skin color analogy, and that'll tell you it'll be Africans. That has a lot of pharmacological potential because genetic diversity also extends to immunological diversity, meaning Africa has the most diverse, as a population, the most diverse immune systems that produce antibodies to all different types and sorts of bacteria and pathogens, viruses, and what have you. Antibodies that can be studied and used to develop into drugs. And you can sell those drugs for a lot of money, as well as other things like proteins that, you know, do certain things like not just, you know, help with muscle growth or make your muscle strong, but also bone growth. You can extract a trait or a gene from an African that's extreme that makes that African's bones particularly strong while also being, you know, flexible. And so you can turn that into an osteoporosis pill and sell that. So I'm worried that what they're doing right now with African genomics is they're trying to get more African DNA. And they're selling this or trying to sell it to Africans under the guise of, if we know more about your genes, we can tailor better medical treatments to you. And that's actually true. That's correct. They could do that. But they could also turn that into a weapon and also privatize and capitalize off of that. So I would just caution Africans that, you know, I'm not going to tell you you have to do anything, but if you care about the global African population maintaining as much control over Africa, Africans, and African resources as possible, please do not give anyone your genetic material, because
Amen.
That genetic material, I can't speak on it now because I don't have as much time, is one of the most important resources on the planet. It comes even before food, and I know some people probably think that's a tall claim, but I can back that claim up. I'll do that later. It's one of the most important resources on the planet. So that's all I'll say.
All right. Thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You did a tremendous job. But listen, we'll talk soon, and we will make this happen very soon. I got to bring in my last guest, and from there, we'll take it from there and see where we at. Let me bring in my good friend, Jesse. Jesse, talk to me. You got your minutes that you requested, and go right ahead.
Thank you, sir. Basically, this is another invitation to demand from our legislators to restore our democracy, our constitution, and our civil rights. According to my government and law professors, the deep state has captured the courts and even the executive, and at the federal and state levels. Then the only option is appealing to our legislators. And even when many legislators are already sold out, many are God-loving and refuse to sell the future of our children and the future of our country to the best bidder. Recently, I read my flyer to some of the most important cities in Texas and by phone, you know, and also to some school districts, and I'm going to read it very quick here. I have been homebound for more than 7 years with a life-threatening electrosensitivity, which is caused and aggravated by the same microwave radiation surveillance reaching children at school. I'm sleep-deprived and in pain all the time. Every day is a different torture. This is a horrible way to die. Evidence on the federal record proves that my EHS was caused by a retaliatory radiation surveillance, which uses the same radiation used for surveillance in schools. My EHS has been recognized by federal and state agencies and courts as a physical medical condition and as a disability. It is estimated that without knowing, more than 50% of the population is already suffering symptoms of EHS. Children, teachers, doctors, attorneys, and even a director of the World Health Organization are suffering from EHS. See, we are the evidence.org. Despite that EHS is reaching pandemic proportions, most doctors are in the dark or in denial and continue misdiagnosing and mistreating with harmful drugs and unnecessary invasive procedures, symptoms and signs that disappear by just avoiding or reducing exposure to microwave radiation. On November 2016, the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton admitted in open court that because of my life-threatening EHS, incarceration is for me a death sentence, and then in response to counter lawsuits, Paxton admitted that he attempted to enforce by incarceration fraudulent child support orders to conceal with my murder the collusion of the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, with the Hidalgo County Criminal District Attorney Ricardo Rodriguez, and with the school officials and others, and the attempts to conceal that a massive medical malpractice and a massive Medicaid and Medicare fraud are used to conceal that the microwave radiation at school is causing children EHS and brain, blood, eye, nerve, heart, and DNA damage, and other catastrophic and irreversible harm and disabilities that defeat the purpose of the education, and to conceal that exposure to microwave radiation is also maiming and torturing to death teachers, firefighters, police officers, and other unsuspecting victims. Furthermore, evidence on the record proves how under fabricated excuses on national security, Abbott, Paxton, and Rodriguez, in collusion with federal agents and prosecutors, engaged in other acts of domestic terrorism, including attempts to conceal that government-sponsored bullying, hate groups are provoking children and the mentally disabled to commit mass shootings and other acts of terrorism to justify the massive and harmful direct radiation surveillance of schools and even homes, and to conceal that the future of our children and the future of our country and our national security are being sold to the deep state, wireless, big pharma, and to the medical industrial complexes, as detailed by the petition to impeach three federal judges, by the relevant evidence to the Patrick Crucius case, and by the criminal complaint of domestic terrorism against Abbott, Paxton, and Rodriguez, submitted to federal authorities and posted on the case law section of wireless wirelesswatchblog.org, wirelesswatchblog.org. Sir, thank you for the opportunity.
All right, Jesse, listen, you hang in there. You stay tough, you hear?
Don't, yes, sir. Thank
don't
you.
Don't let them ride you down. All right, let's talk during the week. All right.
Yes, sir.
All right, that was my good friend Jesse. Yeah, let me bring in Belinda Parker Brown. And to close out the show, talk to me, Belinda Parker Brown. Talk to me, girl.
Pastor Pickney, wow, I'm telling you, you having a fantastic, dynamic show. I mean, just very impactful. So much just good information. Especially the young man that came on there and broke down, you know, some of the logistics about this racism and all of this this sickness that we're dealing with and that's being exposed and coming out in 2020 thanks to Donald Trump. So, Pastor Pickney, I know that our time is short, but I need everybody that's on this call right now to listen carefully. I need help here in Louisiana. And what we're asking right now is that everybody go and register and that you send it out, Pastor Pickney, to all of your listeners, you know, that's come to your show today, that they click on this link and be a part of a very, very important press conference that the whole world need to know about what's going on here in the state of Louisiana. We're saying that Louisiana is first in this curse, and we didn't caught them with their draws down. And everybody needs to come to this press conference and hear about what is about to happen in regards to the state of Louisiana being exposed, Pastor Pickney, with your help. You know, you've been here to Louisiana, and you have seen firsthand yourself how bad it really is here. The whole world was watching when Kathleen Blanco, the governor of the state of Louisiana, she put out a order to shoot to kill all the people that was crossing the bridge during Katrina to get to higher ground to keep them drowning. So we know that Louisiana, Pastor Pickney, is on the map for change, and we are not going to stand idly by. We didn't caught them and put their back up against the wall, and we're saying that the whole world need to come and be a part of what happens when people stand up and unite and come together for the real change that the world need to see right here in the state of Louisiana, Pastor Pickney.
You got the
this
link?
Press conference, you know, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Do you have the link to send out?
Yes, I just texted to you. I have also emailed it to you. And, you know, it's going to take place on this Tuesday, December the 22nd. It's going to be at 2 o'clock p.m. Central Time. That's 2 o'clock p.m. Central Time on December the 22nd.
Okay, well, I got the link, and what I'm going to do, I'm going to send it out. And for all my listeners, everybody who texts me today, I'm going to give you that link. And we plan to tune in at well, it's 3 o'clock my time. We'll tune in Tuesday at 3 p.m., and I'm going to send the link out to everybody, and I want you to send the link out to other people. If you can do that, we can be successful. Belinda Parker Brown, on that note, I got to say good night, but you make sure you send me that link, and I'll make sure I get it out for you.
Thank you, Pastor Pickney, so much. I really appreciate that. It's very, very important now that we all unite and come together, because when they see what this is really all about, that Louisiana United is taking the lead to expose
mm-hmm.
and put these people up against the wall, we're going to wake up this sleeping giant, and we're going to make it known to the whole world what we can do about it. Thank you, Pastor Pickney.
All right, then. That was my good friend, Belinda Parker Brown, from Louisiana. Listen, I'm going to send that link out. You can see it on my website, and let's make it happen. On that note, we got to say goodnight.